Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, Mark.
I'm glad to hear it. I know today we're going to be talking about some issues that investors may find mysterious. Is that right?
Well, it's not just investors who find this mysterious. It's also their attorneys and developers, et cetera, et cetera.
Ooh, well, we're getting very mysterious. And sorry, at the top of the show.
As you know, Mark, there's a lot of areas in EB5 which are difficult to understand. There's a lot of nuances, and there's a lot of small issues, not so small issues, which really leave people sort of wondering, what really does that mean?
Right. It's investors, it's attorneys, and even some consultants. You know, I've been working in the EB5 industry for 7 years. We have almost 50 episodes of this podcast, and each and every episode, I'm still learning more. That's thanks a lot to our special guests. And today, we've got a great guest lined up.
We have indeed.
Today, we have Osvaldo Torres. But he's taken it easy on us as well as everyone else. He likes to be called Ozzy. Right, Ozzy?
Correct. Since third grade, when I came here to this country, I was tagged with Ozzy, and I'll go with that.
Sounds great. Well, let me go ahead and introduce you to our listeners. Ozzy practices at Torres Law Firm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. For his entire career spanning nearly 30 years, Mr. Torres has consulted clients on complex transactions, including securities offerings and mergers and acquisitions. For the last 6 years, Mr. Torres has been immersed in EB5 work and has prepared numerous offerings involving hotel development, residential construction, senior living complexes, healthcare, restaurants, franchises, and many others. Mr. Torres, I know you're frequently a speaker at EB5 conferences, so it's my pleasure to have you with us on EB5 Investment Voice.
It's entirely my pleasure. I'm very pleased to be here, and I thank you for this opportunity to address your concerns and the concerns of the audience.
Ozzy, thank you. And you're going to keep it simple and easy for the listener. That's what I love about the way you speak.
I'll try my very best. Thank you.
Well, these are issues are tough, as I've just said. I'm going to just jump straight in and give you something that has been getting a lot of new investors scratching their heads and older people who in the business who already know how the game is run, looking at their paperwork in a slightly different way. And here I'm going to refer to admin fees, administration fees. So very briefly, for the audience or the listener who's not sure what an administration fee is, whenever you've go into a regional center project, maybe a pool direct project, there is an administrative fee, which isn't part of your capital investment. So it's an administrative fee on top of your $500,000. Ozzy, when we started this business, the admin fee was like back at 10 years ago, it used to be something like $20,000, $25,000. And now this administration fee can be anywhere near $50,000 to $70,000.
Yes, the administrative fee is something that has often befuddled investors as well as other parties. And it certainly befuddled me at the beginning as well when I first started looking at EB5. You know, in a normal securities offering, what you might see is offering proceeds, and that's a certain amount. And then there's the cost of the offering, which is a number that's netted from that amount. Of course, in EB5, we can't net any amount off the capital investment.
Right.
Because as we know, that $500,000 or $1 million, depending on whether it's in a targeted employment area or not, that $500,000 capital investment has to be at all times at risk. And so therefore, the entire amount has to be put to create jobs, and we cannot deduct any expenses off of that amount. As a result, most projects, just about every EB5 project, has a component for an administrative fee, which is used to defray certain costs.
But Ozzy, what happens if the project uses administration fee as part of the operating capital within the project? That's allowed, right?
So the administrative fee, usually, obviously, it's detailed as to what it's going to be used for. So that fee, as a general matter, we state is for defraying offering expenses and other expenses relating to the offering. It can be used for operational expenses as well if any is left over.
Right. Well, at the end of the day, right now, I think most people in the industry look at admin fees as a way to pay commissions.
That is correct.
And that's where a lot of people get into trouble, both in security violations and using in other ways too, right?
Well, it is completely common for that administrative fee. And again, going back to the notion of an offering and having offering expenses, commissions would be an offering expense that usually would be netted from the offering proceeds. But here, as we just stated, we cannot do that. In fact, administrative fees are often used to pay agents their commissions or finder's fees.
Okay, so here we have a real estate broker comes by, and the real estate broker says, look, Ozzy, I've got this regional center, and I've got them three of my clients who are buying property. They also want to do EB-5. I know they're paying more than $500,000. In fact, they're paying $570,000 to this regional center. I want some of that $70,000 as my finder's fee because I'm allowed that in real estate. I get my commission in real estate. What's wrong here?
Well, that's a beautiful thing for a broker to be able to get a commission in real estate, and that's what they're licensed to do. But in this world of securities law and EB-5 offerings and regular offerings, only those persons that are licensed as broker-dealers are permitted to get commissions. So real estate brokers cannot be paid a commission.
Well, if that happens and there's no commission and this real estate broker is saying, look, these are my friends too, and if you're not going to give me commission, then I'm going to tell my colleague about this or I'm going to tell the investor about this and the investor is going to ask for the administration fee to be reduced. Is that possible?
We have to always remember that an offering has to be uniform. So it is not proper to charge one person one fee and not the other investor the same fee. It does present issues of irregularity.
Yeah, but Ozzy, on a practical basis, though, it is done.
It is done, although I would prefer that the offering documents at least disclose the possibility that we could enter into side letters or that we have the right to modify the amount of the administrative fee. But let's remember, this is really all about disclosure, and we have to be sure that if we're going to do something that's aberrational, that at least we provide some disclosure regarding that possibility.
So if somebody comes into a project and they don't have an agent, they can request that the administration fee be lowered?
I think that, again, I would probably answer it the same way. I would want to make sure that my offering documents provide for that flexibility, and right, especially the operating agreement.
Right. So going back to the admin fee, why is there such a discrepancy in your opinion as to, I mean, why do some regional centers say take it just as 10% at 50,000 and some at 65 and some at 70? There seems to be no real sort of uniformity of an admin fee.
So I do agree that back several years ago, the administrative fee seemed to be lower. I think what drives the amount of that administrative fee these days is essentially what brokers, what migration agents are demanding. And most of the time, especially if they want to front load their fees, they're asking for the entire administrative fee or more, obviously.
Right. The or more is definitely there.
Yes.
So if a broker gets paid all of the administrative fee, does the investor know about that? Or does the investor find out about how much the broker gets paid?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, we all know the answer to it too.
Yes. And we could say in the beginning in these offering documents, I'm talking 5 or 6 years going back here.
Which is just a lifetime in VP5.
We're neophytes, you know, it was like in the embryonic stages. First of all, some people thought it wasn't a security, which, you know, right, that's been dispelled. But we have to remember, so back in the beginning, a few people really focused on disclosing what that commissions were being paid or what that fee was being used for. But we should all obviously know that the securities laws require that the payment of commissions and the amount of that commission should be disclose because it is most likely a material item. Now, let's think about that for a second, because my experience has been that when you're dealing with an agent, the last thing they want their investor to know is that the entire administrative fee is going into the agent's pocket. So the fact that they want to make sure that that's not disclosed, I think renders it essentially material. Because what is material to an investor? If an investor's mind would be changed because of some fact that's been omitted or misrepresented, that's the essence of securities fraud.
I happen to totally agree with you here, because I feel if an investor knows that their particular broker has been paid, say, $50,000 for introducing them, then they would certainly look at that broker with a different viewpoint, especially if they were asking specific questions about the project and the broker couldn't answer it but kept saying, no, no, you have to go into this project. It's the best, it's the best, it's the best. Then I do think then it is important that an investor does understand. But I think in today's day and age, a lot of investors do have an idea that, you know, there is a fee paid to his broker.
That is correct. And that's because I think the industry has taken a turn for the better. And I think I think that's a good thing. You know, the other thing about that point is that before they may not have known that the administrative fee was going to the agent, because the agent most likely was charging them a separate fee to begin with. So then when you start doubling up or whatever on the fee, it starts to look like a pretty big number. In any event, another very important point that you raised is about the, you know, the conflict or the incentive that that agent has to close the deal, which we call really the salesman's stake, right?
Yes.
Which is the hallmark of a commission. When a person is trying to sell you something and you don't know that they have an interest in making that sale occur because they're going to get paid money, that's important. And so that's the whole essence of the salesman's stake and commissions, and that's why it's regulated.
Right. And I think it's certainly well known in places like China. But I think that now that we're seeing the market move so much in places like India, that it's not as perhaps well known exactly what it's utilized for. And I know a number of regional centers have added a legal fee onto the admin fee. And I'm one of the people who is dead against that, because I believe a legal fee should be paid to the attorney to make that attorney accountable and not really connected with a regional center where there could be a conflict at a later stage.
Well, again, generally speaking, the administrative fee has always been used to defray offering expenses and to pay commissions. So to the extent that the project or the fund, the EB-5 fund, actually have legal expenses, which they should, there's nothing improper, in my opinion, about using a portion of the administrative fee to defray those kinds of costs.
Okay. Well, one last question on admin fees, Ozzy, before we move on to other areas. We have a developer, a small developer who's doing raising some money for his own project. Maybe it's just a handful of people. And all of the people give him the administration fee. And he utilizes some of the administration fee for some of the expenses for the project, and some of it he uses it for some personal expenses. Is that allowed, as he's the developer?
So again, a very good question. And of course, it has to do with the essence of disclosure. Most likely the administrative fee was described, as I said before, to defray offering expenses, etc. I doubt that there's any disclosure that would say so anybody can put it in their pocket. So the answer is absolutely not.
So even if he's the developer, there isn't an exception for him to use the money for himself. He has to use the money for project specific purposes.
Well, if we had an offering that basically said, oh, the administrative fee could be used for X, Y, and Z, and also for that purpose, then presumably there shouldn't be a problem.
But Bazi, most of the language in most PPMs is very vague. You kind of can use administrative fee for anything.
I would tend to agree with that. But personal use obviously goes beyond the bounds of any expected use.
Right,
no matter
right.
how broadly right. it's written, right?
Right. Well, I wasn't really talking about buying a yacht I was referring more to maybe other expenses related to the project, but maybe not specifically related in the actual use of funds.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that'd be a case-by-case basis, and we would have to dig into the documents to make sure that I wouldn't want to be in that situation, but...
Well, marketing expenses are usually allowed.
Yes. Yeah. That would be theoretically an offering expense, right?
Right, right. So Ozzy, really, it isn't necessary, though, for every offering to have an administrative fee. I mean, is there a possibility that somebody comes forward and maybe has an maybe five project where they don't want to or they don't use a PPM, and therefore they don't even have an administrative fee issue?
Well, I think that would be highly unlikely. But let's talk about that for a second. There are always going to be expenses of an offering.
Like legal expenses.
Like legal expenses. You know, somebody does have to prepare whatever documents are necessary. So we can talk about what becomes necessary and when. But at the end of the day, I think that unless someone is willing to self-fund and not be reimbursed for those expenses, yes, you could argue that an administrative fee is not necessary in that case. But I think that's a very, very rare case.
Well, let me give you an example of what we are seeing happening more and more frequently. And I can see this increasing when the minimum amount eventually is raised from 500 to 950 or whatever fee final figure they have. A couple of friends come together and they put money together. They pull money together to do an EB-5 project. They realize that they are able to create a considerable amount of jobs. Perhaps they only thought they could create 20 jobs, and maybe they can create 30 to 40 jobs. So they decide to bring another person into their project. And the other person is brought in, but that person isn't necessarily managing the project or part of the project. Now, they are continuing as if the original plan was it was just the two friends, and now they're bringing in this third person. They don't feel they need a PPM. Do they need a PPM?
And that third person is going to be an investor. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. This is happening a lot. We're seeing a lot of direct pool projects where there is no PPM.
And that raises a very good point, and I appreciate the question. When parties get together and they all decide that they're going to form a company, then theoretically, nobody is soliciting the other, and it could be argued that no offering document is necessary.
So you're saying wherever there's a solicitation, there has to be an offering.
Exactly. Whenever there is somebody that is looking to bring another person into a deal, you have to ask yourself, okay, how are they doing that? What are they representing as far as the deal goes? How are they getting or enticing that person to come into the deal? And so the essence of those types of conversations or discussions or machinations is really at the core of disclosure, okay? And all the securities laws try to do is ensure that there is disclosure of material information and no omission of material information. So right. In your scenario where two people started a deal and then they ask a third party to come in, if I were the founding parties, I would want to rely on a disclosure document that sets forth what the project is, what the expectations are, and that contains the risk factors and all of these other things that we should look at so that someone can make an informed decision, you know, the investment decision.
But Ozzy, if people are putting money together and they're counting every penny, then having a disclosure document like that will increase the overall cost of the project. And I think that's one reason why people feel they don't need to have a PPM.
Well, sometimes we're penny wise and pound foolish. And, you know, that's unfortunate because, again, if there's a sponsor or promoter that's looking to get people into a deal, it's really that sponsor promoter that should be concerned about ensuring that they're not exposing themselves to the argument later on that, oh, you told me it was going to be this, or you told me it was going to return 30%, and, you know, that turned out not to be true. So, again, I understand, obviously, the economics of a small deal, but we can work on what an alternative to a full-blown PPM, which is called essentially an access letter under Reg D. And under Reg D, as long as we have accredited investors, we could essentially put together a mini PPM or mini disclosure document, which at least provides some protection.
Well, that's good to know, and it's good for our listeners to know, because this is something which we are seeing more and more frequently. But let me ask you something. When would you say categorically you do not need an PPM?
I would say that where several people get together and they all form a company and they're founders of that company, I think it could be argued that there's no offering that's taking place. Now, in the EB-5 world, I find that almost difficult to imagine, because you're going to need somebody in the States to do something here.
So, Ozzy, on the converse, if a PPM is required and a person puts a deal together and they do not have a PPM, what could happen?
To answer that question, we need to know what type of investors were being solicited or involved and what kind of offering, if any, really took place. If we have a Reg D offering, as I mentioned, and they're accredited investors, theoretically, no disclosure document needs to be provided. If there was a reliance upon the Reg S exemption, which is the offshore exemption, then we must have a disclosure document. So at the end of the day, you're basically, you know, following your point here, you're basically flying naked and you have no protections against allegations that a statement you made was true or untrue, because the beauty of a properly drafted disclosure document is that it contains all of the material information pursuant to which someone can make an investment decision. And in a lawsuit, it would be easier to prove that there was reliance upon that PPM, and hopefully it was an adequate document.
Right. That basically, that PPM can save a developer from a lawsuit. But on a practical note, it is probably also likely that USCIS might reject that petition.
I would think that they're used to seeing a disclosure document. That's why I don't recommend that one not be included, even if it's the short form one that I mentioned for smaller deals.
Well, it's nice to hear that the developer has some kind of protection, but it's also there to protect the investor too.
That is correct. I mean, I think that if you're an investor and you're relying upon a document containing everything that's supposed to be in there, and it fails in some measure, then the failure of that disclosure is what is going to give rights to an action by those investors against the project.
Well, Ozzy, I appreciate you fully exploring these administration fees with Mona and myself. Let me ask you about this new proposed legislation and some of the protections that are set up, because I know you've mentioned how some of the offering documents and offering memorandums and the private placement memorandums could be flexible, could say that administration fees could be used for this, or maybe they don't. And we've covered a little bit on how they could and could not be used. But what protections do you see coming into place with proposed legislation?
Well, as we have seen in many of the proposals for legislative reform, integrity and integrity issues are at the core of some of these legislative proposals. And I think that's heading in the right direction, and I don't think anybody in the industry has any issue regarding integrity and integrity reform. What we see, I think, in most of these deals that may have gone bad is essentially affiliated party transactions where the project or developer and the EB-5 fund are managed by the same control persons. And for instance, when we look at a J-Peak scenario, that's exactly the problem. So some of these integrity reforms would impose certain regulations to ensure that there is more transparency and financial controls.
As well as offering third-party oversight, I believe, Ozzy, right?
Correct. And that's what I mean by the financial controls, where a third party would have to be involved to ensure that funds were being expended in the manner in which the project describes it. So that's an important element. Now, I think that element is critical where, as I mentioned, you have the same control persons on both sides, essentially the borrower and the lender, if you will, in the EB-5 loan model scenario. Where, however, you have sophisticated developer on the other end and you have an independent regional center or EB-5 fund making an arm's length loan or investment into the project, I don't think those kinds of controls are necessary. And in any event, where there's a senior lender on the project side, you're going to have built-in controls, and if not, you know, money managers or construction draw.
Would senior lenders, would they be involved with the administration fees or the amount of the investment itself? I guess my thought is, you know, while we're waiting for legislation to clarify and perhaps strengthen some of the protections and the integrity matters or issues that may be real or perceived, people could use third-party oversight, you know, now, should they choose to, or look for funds that have that. So in the case of third-party oversight, or perhaps not, perhaps there's a senior respected lender in the industry that's associated with that project. Are they also working with the administration fees as well?
You know, honestly, the administrative fee, I don't think ever gets to the project.
Right, exactly. That's kind of the root of my question.
Yeah, so
I would argue against that, Ozzy. I think that used to be the case in the olden days when there was a lot more coming out of China. But I think recently, with the latest trends, there is an admin fee going into the project.
So whether it goes in or out or around or through, who sees it other than the investor that pays it and the project that takes it? Would third-party oversight or senior lender be involved at all with the administration fee?
Well, we need to back up a sec. So when I think about the administrative fee is going to go to the fund or the general partner of the fund, or it's otherwise going to go completely to migration agents or otherwise. So when I say the project, I really mean the development, okay? The job creating entity. Generally speaking, the funds that make it over to the job creating entity is the capital, right? That's been raised.
Right.
And that's usually where we see oversight and the senior lenders involved is with the job creation entity. So correct. It sounds like where you're going is that they would not have oversight over the administration fee or how it's used.
The only oversight, if you can call it that, on the administrative fee side is the conditions to escrow and escrow release.
And where would an investor look for that?
So generally, I mean, many of these deals do have an escrow agent or some kind of escrow structure. And the administrative fee, along with the capital contribution, goes to an escrow agent. And then you have conditions to escrow release built into the escrow agreement that is entered into with the escrow agent. Generally speaking, these days, you may be looking at a 526 petition filing as a trigger for the release of the administrative fee, as well as the capital contribution, although there may be a holdback generally as to the capital contribution amount.
And also, Ozzy, that means that the administrative fee gets paid into escrow if there is an escrow agent, and it doesn't get paid directly to the regional center or the developer.
I mean, where there is an escrow, that's usually the case, although I have seen deals where the administrative fee bypasses the escrow as well.
Oh, interesting.
And goes right into the NCE or the general partner of the NCE.
Yes, yes, you're right, Ozzy. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
I agree, Ozzy. Thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.